Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Serious Issues, a weekly comic book podcast brought to you by King's Comics in Sydney. 403 George Street in Sydney is where you can go to find all of the comics that we talk about in today's episode, and every episode before this, and all the episodes that we record in the future.
Whoa.
That's right. Kingscomics.com is where you can go if you don't live in Sydney. And we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of comics that came out in the last week. My name is Levins.
My name is Siobhan.
And we begin every episode by reviewing all of the number ones. Before we do that, we have some bonus episodes in the mix.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're in the regular feed too. This isn't some like dirty scheme for us trying to get you to give us money. Although you should give us money.
I mean, you could. Just consider it.
But we did a bonus episode last week, which you'll find in the feed, with Andrew Constant, who is mm-hmm. the writer of The Demon, Hell is Earth, which the trade of which has just come out through DC Comics. So we did a Halloween comics special with him mm-hmm. last week. Came out on Halloween. And we got the signing. How did that go?
Yeah, it was good. Good fun.
Yep. What, which body part did he sign of yours?
All of them.
Wow.
I'm sorry. None of them.
And later on this week, there'll be another bonus episode with the creator. We hit a Patreon goal where we have to interview a creator every month. So we're making up for lost time and we reviewed two in 2 weeks.
That's pretty good.
But Matt Groom is a Sydney-based writer whose debut series, Self-Made, is coming out through Image Comics on the 6th of December. And so we did a chat with him, which will go up later in the week. So keep your eyes peeled for some great conversations with some local creators, and mm-hmm. we look forward to doing more of them in the future.
Yeah.
We also have been doing for patrons a post show in which we review graphic novels, mm-hmm. and you can hear them by supporting us over at patreon.com/seriousissuespodcast. That's the one. And last week we. I can't remember what I reviewed last week.
I talked about Von Spatz, a new Drawn and Quarterly, and I also talked about Monster.
What did I talk about?
You talked about... this is bad because I only care about what I talk about.
And I only talk about... Actually, I remembered Von Spatz, so I'm the better person of the two of us. That took a photo. It's me holding Louisa.
Yeah, there we go.
Then and Now, which is a book came out through... Now and Then, sorry. Came out through Humanoids that I really loved. This week, Siobhan... I am I'm like two-thirds of the way through Bone.
Cool.
The enormous, like, 1,300-something page monster by Jeff Smith, mm-hmm. written and drawn by Jeff Smith. I've never read it before in my life.
Me neither.
God, I'm loving it so much, and I can't wait to tell you about it later.
Cool. I'm reading a novel.
Okay. Wow, a book without pictures. I didn't even know they still made those.
I know. It's been a very strange experience for me. But it's sort of comic booky, so I feel like people will
enjoy it.
It's called Slade House by David Mitchell.
Okay, cool. Looking forward to hearing more about it later in the post show, which you can access at patreon.com/seriousissuespodcast. We do a bonus 15 and 20 minutes, a little extra review for everyone that wants to support us, just at a nice $5 a month level, which gets you a whole bunch of extra content.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, everyone already does, and looking forward to meeting everyone who was about to. Now let's get into the show. Every week we talk about all of last week's number one issues. We call this segment First Things First. And DC put out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 number ones this week.
I did not read all of them.
Well, it was a Halloween week, which meant that we had the last gasp of spooky Halloween comics. Mm-hmm. So we have a couple of them to talk about. But the spookiest thing of all, Siobhan, and I just one of the scariest things that the comics world unleashes upon us every few months is another round of DC and Hanna-Barbera mashup comics. And this week we got Deathstroke Yogi Bear, Green Lantern Huckleberry Hound, Nightwing Megilla Gorilla, and Superman Top Cat.
I just couldn't do it to myself this month. I just didn't think that was going to be good, me going, I hate this. But I did read one of them. It's, because of the creative team.
Yeah, sure. So that is one reason to read this. Another reason is just like, even though, yeah, it's very rare that I enjoy it, there is just something so bananas. Like, you see the two characters in the front, you see the creative team, you're like, I've got a fair idea of how this could go down. And it's never anything like that.
Never.
It's always just like the most insane, like, how did this get published experience?
But it's very rarely good.
But when it is, it's great. Yeah, it gives us things like Flintstones and the Tom King Elmer Fudd book. And there have been like a lot of great moments to come out of these collaborations. So let's begin. Each one of these stories came with a four-part story featuring Secret Squirrel. That was.
I don't know who that is.
I mean, that's fine that you don't. You can live your life without ever knowing.
Because I've done it so far.
The Secret Squirrel comic was bizarre.
Yeah, I couldn't actually read it, given that I only read like part two or four, but I was like, this is madness. What is this?
Just quickly, J.M. Mateus wrote the Secret Squirrel backups with Tom Mandrake on art. And in the start, it opens with Secret Squirrel. Apparently, this spins out of a recent issue of Scooby Apocalypse.
Well, there you go.
But which is still like a really well-selling DC book, which is just
people
insane.
Love it.
So Secret Squirrel, who is just a squirrel that wears a purple hat,
yeah, nice.
is lying in the Caribbean on a deck chair with a bikini-clad babe.
You know he's a success if a naked woman is near him.
So
semi-naked.
The woman says, considering we spend most of our lives engaging in government-approved murder and mayhem, a vacation is not an indulgence, it's a necessity. And then Secret Squirrel turns to his lady and says, speaking of indulgence, how about I indulge your libido a little? And then
she says,
that would be the fourth time this morning, but who's counting? So...
Blurg.
Yeah.
Blurg.
Just no good.
Nah. Cheers, mate.
Just a real fragment of the past that shouldn't return.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the same can be said for a lot of these issues. So let's talk about Deathstroke Yogi Bear, which was written by Frank Thierry with Mark Texiera on art and Jeremy Cox on colors. A much better art team than this book deserves. This one, I guess, is kind of like, you know, I didn't enjoy it, but at least it was kind of made sense. It just, you know, Deathstroke running amok in Jellystone Park.
Okay.
And helping Yogi just take down some
people.
Assassins. Yeah, there's a lot of murder in this book, which is not something that I expect from a Yogi Bear book.
Is always,
yeah, exactly. But there was a funny page of Deathstroke like kind of killing his way through various like bad guys in the Hanna-Barbera world. Which I'm trying to find for you now. He's not even killing, just him beating up like King Shark, Jabberjaw, Killer Croc, Wally Gator, Gorilla Grodd, and Grape Ape.
Okay.
And it was funny, like, and just weird. Like, this is the kind of fun, goofy stuff that I expect from this comic. So this was like, of the four of them, even though I didn't like it, it was easily the best.
That was the best?
Yeah.
No, I disagree, and I didn't even read all of them.
Well, let's talk about the one that we both did read together.
This Green Lantern Huckleberry Hound by Mark Russell with art by someone. Someone pretty good doing a very good sort of Silver Agey DCU vibe.
Rick Leonardi with inks by Dan Green and Andy Parks with colors by Steve Buccolato.
So I think I liked this because this was set in the 70s during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And it's about John Stewart, Green Lantern, and... he is told by Katma, who was his lover/teacher in the Green Lantern Corps, and she says, the hardest part is going back to your planet and not using your ring. And he comes back and he faces the sort of world of 1970s America, which is racist and sexist, and all of his friends and his family are dying in a needless, unjust war. And he meets Huckleberry Hound in a bar and they, you know,
hit it off.
A conversation. I liked this. You didn't like this?
I hated this so much. Yeah. And wow. I loved Mark Russell's Flintstones. I loved Mark Russell's Snagglepuss. That both like defied my expectations of what you could do with like this, you know, reimagining of these, you know, characters that don't really need to return to anyone's world.
No.
But I just thought, you know, and he definitely, you know, he didn't hide his politics in either of those books. And, you know, I happen to agree with him on almost everything he talks about. But I thought this is the first example of his politics being so preachy in the comic book. Yeah. I just thought this was just kind of dumb.
See, I do disagree. I thought this was like a pretty good social commentary. Like, given the flippin', editorial mandate of Huckleberry Hound having to be in it, I thought that he did a pretty good job of kind of addressing a number of different issues that existed in Jon Stewart's life, and I thought it was pretty well-paced, and I thought it was pretty interesting.
But this is the only one where it's only been about, like, the movement of the time. Like, there was no... Like, neither of them did anything very Green Lantern-y or Huckleberry Hound-ish. Like,
he did some Green Lantern-y stuff. It starts with him on a crazy planet fighting a big wasp guy.
I liked it when he had, like, I'm obviously saying, you know, racism is terrible and a part of our history that none of us should be proud of.
Levins is very pro-racism. That's not
inherently political anymore.
No, of course.
But I just found that, yeah, like, I don't know, I just thought it was just weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought this was pretty good, actually.
Look, give me Deathstroke hunting down Hanna-Barbera characters, apparently.
You're terrible.
Well, I didn't like that comic either. I just liked it more than this one.
Wow. I find you crazy.
So now we move on to Nightwing Megilla Gorilla.
Come on.
This was a trip.
You're trying to tell me that this was
no, this was
better?
This was maybe the most bafflingly worst one of them.
Is Megilla Gorilla? Is he just a big talking gorilla?
Yeah, who works in showbiz.
Okay. Okay.
Someone asked me what this book was like, and so I, from memory, wrote down what happened. Hold on, let me get to it, because I was pretty proud of it. So this is what happens. In a book that was written by Heath Corson, with pencils by Tom Grummett and Tom Derenick, with inks by Cam Smith and Andy Owens, colors by Pete Pantazis. So, in the Megilla Megorilla Nightwing comic, Megilla Gorilla invites Dick Grayson over to his mansion because he wants to make a movie based on the life of the Flying Graysons. Dick doesn't let him, so Megilla screams at his manager. We then learn that his manager has been strangled to death, and Megilla is wanted for murder, but Dick thinks that Megilla is innocent, so he helps him escape, and Megilla destroys a police helicopter in the process. What? He suspects that he was framed by his sister, who was addicted to heroin,
what?
But after she gives a good alibi, he decides that it was his rival Grape Ape, who they then go and fight in a nightclub. Turns out it was Grape Ape's best friend, who's like another animal character, who killed the manager, and then he tries to shoot everyone, and Megilla takes a bullet for Grape Ape, and in doing so, like, fixes their friendship. And the book ends with Dick Grayson greenlining the Flying Graysons movie after all, with Megilla Gorilla playing his dad and Grape Ape playing Dick Grayson.
I can't stop shaking my head. I'm
but
so
there are
upset
no,
by
and
this.
There are also no other primate characters in the cast. It's just these two apes playing two human characters.
Actually, you know what? You've sold me. Sounds
this
great.
This is so insanely stupid.
That sounds so weird. You know, I just wish that they could... Who wants a story in which Megilla Gorilla's sister is addicted to heroin? Why does anyone
who
want that?
Who writes a story where it's I don't know what to do with this franchise.
You know what this needs? More heroin.
It's so weird. This is like the legacy of the New 52 lives on through these bizarre Hanna-Barbera mashups.
I wish they would end. I wish they would stop doing this.
I've kind of
it makes it so embarrassing to be like a DC person.
Yeah, it's so bizarre.
So terrible.
The final one was this is so fun. Superman Top Cat. Okay, I feel bad for saying Green Lantern and Thingo was bad, but I just. Like, I have expectations for Mark Russell, and...
I thought this lived up to my expectations of Mark Russell, but I accept that it wasn't your favourite. But you know whose fault this whole fucking thing is?
I know, it's very true. It's Dan DiDio, who was the writer of Superman Top Cat. He's also the...
Is Top Cat also just, like, a showbiz animal? He's wearing a waistcoat.
Well, he was like, he's an alley cat.
Okay.
And he has all these other alley cats, and he hangs out, and he tricks people into giving him food and stuff.
Ah, so he does crimes.
Yeah, exactly. But in this one, he is trying to make ends meet, and he has a job at like a supermarket. But there's an attack of the Kalians.
Because
Kale is actually an alien race, and the aliens return to Earth to wreak havoc on people who have ever, all these hipsters that have been eating kale, and then kale like escapes out of their body and kills them. And Superman is powerless to stop it.
Someone take Dandadia's laptop away from him.
So then he teams up with a cat for some reason, and Top Cat and Superman bring down the Kalians. Yeah, so this said pencils by Shane Davis and Michelle Dalecki on inks.
That's so lame.
Three colorists. Oh my God. Just utterly baffling. I don't know who it's for. I don't understand. Like, because if you like these characters, this is not what these characters are like.
Yeah. You are not getting a good Superman story or a good Top Cat story out of this. So what's the point?
It's so weird.
I don't get it at all.
Anyway, so that was it. Another round of why are DC doing this? Because we also get them doing it with Looney Tunes characters now, too.
Yeah. This whole situation is baffling.
Stop buying these.
Stop buying them, and they'll stop making them. Maybe.
So we've got a couple other DC books to get through. Number ones, Batman Secret Files was a $4.99 big blockbuster issue this week, which featured, of course, the last of their foil covers for October. Featured a group of different creators doing short stories featuring Batman. It opened with a, would you believe, heavy-handed Tom King story.
Good Lord. Like, I feel so tired of his version of Bruce. Like, his version of Batman is so, like, boring and annoying.
Yeah.
Like, a version of Batman that's just constantly like, Alfred, am I enough? Am I good enough? Do you love me? And then Alfred is like, yes, sir, I love you. And he's like, cool, on his phone, ignoring Alfred.
Yeah, totally. Like, cool, fuck off, Dad.
It's like the most annoying, like, jerky version of Bruce Wayne I've ever read.
Yeah, the biggest villain in Tom King's Batman Rogues Gallery is happiness.
Yeah. But, man, I enjoyed most of this issue.
Yep.
I love Batman short stories. I think it's the perfect format for the character. I would like everything to be standalone in the Batman universe, please.
I loved the first one, which was written by Ram V. With Jorge Fornes on art, with Matt Wilson on colors, a great creative team.
Yeah. Like, first what else has Ram V done?
The recent book that Vault put out.
Yes, yes, yes.
Where the vampire travels to, like, I read it recently. It's like, I loved it. I can't remember what it's called.
I remember it.
But it's very, very, very good.
Yeah, cool.
You missed it. And and you're like, damn it, I should have read this.
Right.
And maybe you will one day. But he does a great Scarecrow story, but it's told from the point of view of a cop that tried to take Scarecrow down. And really great, you know, it's
spooky ending.
Yeah, like one that, like an actual like horror Scarecrow story.
Yes.
That kind of, you know, was about the nature of fear. Very, yep. Very enjoyable. And then we got an excellent...
I loved this story by Cheryl Lynn Eaton, with art by Elena Casagrande and Jordi Belair on colors. I think this was one of my favorite stories in the whole thing. This was so cool. This was about like Wayne technology being misused, and it kind of makes the point of like the crimes that you are stopping on the street are starting in your own boardroom. Like you should be paying more attention to this stuff. I thought this was a perfect issue. So good. Perfect little story.
Yeah, definitely. I loved the next one probably the most.
Oh yeah.
Which was the Jordi. Is that written by Jordi Belair?
Jordi Belair with art by Jill Thompson.
Yeah.
Ugh,
which
man.
Is
man.
Yeah. Like, this like, Batman kind of like staking out, in the woods during a snowstorm, and talking about like he's not the biggest fan of himself sometimes. I thought it was a very human Batman story.
Absolutely.
Which I was not expecting, and I really enjoyed it.
Because we very rarely, like, it's all about the Bat fam now. We never see sort of Bruce solo.
Yeah.
You know?
And then it ended on just an unbelievably fun team up between Batman and Detective Chimp by the fucking god Tom Taylor. He's so good.
He's so good. He's so good, and he's so good at putting in like a really genuinely like sentimental sweet ending, but that doesn't feel saccharine. It feels very earned. It's really good fun. He knows how to use Detective Chimp
like, really, really well.
I loved this.
I really hope that now that Injustice is over, that Tom Taylor gets a big DC book where he can just play with so many different characters.
Yeah.
Has he announced one? I can't remember.
I don't know.
I don't know. He's got Marvel books, but yeah, Brad Walker on pencils on this one with Andrew Hennessy on inks. And Jordi Belair on colors. Jordi Belair doing a lot in this issue.
Yeah.
Like a really great collection of great Batman short stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Really good fun. I hope that this is ongoing, because this is if you like Batman,
yeah,
you should absolutely.
My favorite ever Batman run is the Legends of the Dark Knight run, yep. which just has so many great, like, you know, like mini series of fun, like 4 to 6 issue Batman stories. So good.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it to everyone going back. There's some absolute classic Batman stories in that run by a lot of creators, a lot of people love. Obviously, it opens with a great Grant Morrison story, and then mm-hmm. we've got, it ends on an awesome Deadshot one shot.
So good.
That I really love, like one of my favorite comics ever. Yeah, such a great run. So this week we've got two books written by James Tynion IV, who just finished the Justice League Dark and Wonder Woman The Witching Hour team-up miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
And he also started a new miniseries, which is a team-up between Justice League and Aquaman. It's called Drowned Earth. So he wrote The Witching Hour 1. This is the final issue of this. So it's, this is Justice League Dark Wonder Woman number 1, The Witching Hour. And this featured great art from... I've really enjoyed the art completely across this this miniseries. And this had all three of the artists, Jesus Marino, Fernando Blanco, and Miguel Mendoza on art, with Romulo Fiato Jr. on colors. But as a story, this has been all about, like, yeah, like Wonder Woman and a lot of other magic characters were marked by this witch many, many thousands of years ago, and now she's returning to kind of reclaim her power, and with that, all of those who she marked. We just get this enormous info dump. The whole middle of the issue is like telling the backstory of this witch character, and it's just so much unnecessary extra information that I don't think really adds much to the ending of this.
Yeah.
But then the final page reveal shows that Cersei is going to be a major player in either the Wonder Woman or Justice League Dark books in the future. And I really like Cersei, and I like that. I really enjoyed her in this.
I like this version of Cersei. It's a cool character design, and it's good fun.
Yeah. So, yeah, not a very strong end to what I thought was a quite enjoyable run of a little miniseries so far. Drowned Earth. Now, I'm not a big Aquaman fan.
Me neither, and I sort of decided that I wasn't going to read any Aquaman until Kelly Sue DeConnick starts.
Sure.
I don't know why I made that rule, but I did.
There are some, like, I love, even though he only shows up at the very end of DC The New Frontier, I love Darwin Cook's take on Aquaman. Those six panels that he's in are great.
Yep.
I love the Aquaman who shows up in the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon.
Yep.
Voiced by John DiMaggio.
I love Grant Morrison's version of Aquaman, who's just an angry... sea loner with one hook hand.
But basically, perfect. I love Namor, and I would just wish Aquaman was Namor or different enough.
Nah, I like him when he's like more of a freaky sea hobo.
Okay. Oh, you know what? I take it back. I love the recent Dan Abnett, Stefan Sejic take
that
on
was also
Aquaman.
That was
impeccable. You know what? Maybe I am somewhat of an Aqua fan, but especially their second album. Am I right? My Oh My, Do You Want to Say Goodbye?
Good
song. But yeah, so Justice League Aquaman Drowned Earth, written by James Tynion IV, who I am a big fan of, especially the Detective run. I love that he is obviously a massive fan of DC.
Yeah.
This featured art by Howard Porter, who I'm also a big fan of as well.
Is that Miss Martian?
Yeah, so Miss Martian is being used by Batman, I guess, at the moment.
Weird.
For weird stuff. But this is one of those books that I've finished. Like, there's like, basically, like, for some reason, the Earth is being drowned,
cool.
And so Gotham. It opens in Gotham. We have like a flashback, but then we're in Gotham, and like everyone, like half of Gotham is submerged in water, and then once they get submerged in water, they turn into like fish creatures. So Officer Gordon turns into like a fish creature with a moustache.
Weird.
Which is just strange. And so the Justice League are trying to like save everybody from being drowned or turned into fish creatures.
Oh, is it Ocean Master? Is he the bad guy?
Yeah, well, Ocean. No, he's the good guy. He's trying to team up with, what's her name?
Mera.
And then the Legion of Doom have sent Black Manta to kill Aquaman once and for all. And so there's a fight. And it's just one of those ones I was like, I just don't care.
Yeah.
Maybe if I was a much bigger fan of Aquaman, I would care. But I just thought this did not do enough to... there was just so much going on that I didn't care about.
Yeah. I think that this is probably a bit of an editorial thing to try and bring Aquaman into kind of a new phase, because from the ads that I've seen for the new Aquaman series, it looks like Aquaman is fresh start, clean slate, not in a marriage anymore, loner. So I guess that this is probably a bit...
Which is weird, because isn't the movie going to be like a love story between him and Mera?
Man... When will DC ever do anything smart to tie in with their movie releases? When will they ever do anything smart with their movies? Never.
But yeah, Drowned Earth, not a good start to a series that I want to read anymore.
It's weirdly dated.
That's what it really felt like.
Yeah.
But from like a, yeah, it was just, yeah.
No. The colors that they've used or something, it makes it well,
Howard,
look very
Howard Porter is a very 90s looking artist I generally like that.
Same, but I think there's ways to sort of ink and then color it that make it look a bit more
contemporary. Yeah, definitely. I loved his recent issues of Flash that Howard Porter did, but
yeah.
Wasn't a big fan of this. Finally, from DC, we got the Terrifics Annual, which was not written by Jeff Lemire. However, it was written by Gene Luen Yang, who did one story with Joe Bennett on pencils, and Matt Santarelli, Scott Hanna, Richard Friend on inks, and Hi-Fi on colors, which was a just a great little story.
So cute.
This is his first thing that Gene Luen Yang has done since New Superman ended. This was like just a fun kind of like Halloween masked ball story.
Yeah.
In which there's like, you know, essentially like the DC version of Skrulls being made up because of a science experiment gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really enjoyed it. I think Gene Luen Yang would be a great person to step in for Lemire if he ever leaves this book, because he got the personalities of all the four terrific characters done really well. And I actually enjoyed this like more than like the last five issues of the Terrifics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's saying something. And then we got a backup that was written by Mark Russell, who we mentioned earlier in the show, featuring Evan Doc Shaner on art, who the book is always the best when he is doing the art on it.
Yes.
Let this book come out, like put out three issues a year. I don't know what he's, how he's like at keeping up with schedule, but like the book is just so much better when he does the art.
Yeah, it really is.
And Nathan Fairbairn on colors too, one of my favorite colorists who I don't see doing books enough.
Yep.
And Mark Russell doing a story based on, what's this dude's name again? The big
Java.
Java, the ex-caveman dude who's been brought to the future by a scientist. And it was a really fun kind of tragic story about him, kind of setting him up to be like a villain in the future, I guess. And then finally we had a Tom Strong story by James Asmus and Jose Luis and Jordi Tarragona and Hi-Fi that was fine.
Yeah. I think that for me, I really enjoyed the Java story.
Yeah.
I mean, because Doc Shaner.
Yeah, but of course. Yeah,
really, really solid, good little standalone story.
Great writing from Mark Russell too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for me, I love the Gene Luen Yang story as well too. It was good just seeing him understand the team dynamic so quickly in such a short amount of time.
Yep,
lots of fun. Good annual. Finally, from DC/Vertigo, we have Hex Wives, which is a new series written by Ben Blacker with Mirko Andolfo.
Of Unnatural.
That's what I was going to say. That's where I recognize her from. And Marissa Louise on colors. About witches, specifically witches that never die, and we see them being hunted over the course of different generations.
Mm-hmm.
We open in Salem in the 1600s, and the book ends in like the 1950s.
I guess that's supposed to be the 1950s.
Because they're like housewives, but they're also witches.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a lady killer, but witches.
So I really like the concept of this, especially like, you know, yeah, exactly, like the lady killer era of books, that 1950s housewife thing, having a bunch of witches hiding as boring housewives is interesting. I didn't like the dialogue at all in this issue.
Yeah, it was quite a lot of there was quite a lot of lore setting up, and then there's a lot of I didn't hate the dialogue. Wait, which part? Like, did you find the historical dialogue? You know what I hate? You know what I really hate? Is when there's stuff and it says, like, it's all these and thous, and then all of a sudden it'll be like a... Oh, there was one specific one. Let me find it. It really annoyed me.
Just a clue.
Okay, yeah, it's all like thee, thou, and then she goes, Nadi, you're up. Like, just be consistent. That's all I want. If you're going to have them speaking, like, naturalistically now, that's fine. But if you're going to have it be historically accurate, then be sure. Historically accurate.
I guess, you know, it was an ambitious first issue because we
it was a lot.
It would have been cooler, I think, if you open in the 50s setting after a short kind of like glimpse back to the past, and then we learn in future issues that these guys have been doing it for generations upon generations. But
yes.
I think because we had so much time in so many different time periods, and then we're introduced to somebody who is trying to hunt these witches down once and for all, and we learn his backstory as well, it was a lot to take in. For a first issue.
Yeah.
But I think this series could still shows potential, and I might give it another issue.
Yeah, you know, I think that there was just like a lot of groundwork being laid in this issue, and I'm intrigued, to say the very least, so I'm going to come back for issue 2 for sure, at the least.
Okay, maybe it's not set in the 1950s.
Yeah, it's not, I thought there was some, there was not, some you're right. kind of contemporary.
So the last thing
elements?
We see is 2005 New Orleans, yeah, there you and go. Then it goes 3 years later. So
yeah, cool.
They're just regular housewives that happen to look like 50s housewives.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I don't
for some reason.
Now I don't get it now. Okay, now I like this less.
You know what I found weird is that, so one of our characters, I think it's implied that like these witches are reborn into bodies, but they're not like properly reborn until the person first dips their toe into the occult. So I don't think that the witches have yet been reborn. And the witch hunter is married to one of the people who has not yet awoken as a witch. And he's like, I need to get a willing kiss from her. But if you're already married, how come you're not getting willing kisses, buddy?
Oh,
what's going on?
I don't know if you remember 2008, Siobhan, but no one was kissing anybody back then.
Kisses were illegal. Weird. Weird, but I'll read it.
Yeah, I'll give another issue. Definitely.
At least one more.
So over to Marvel now, and we got the Avengers Halloween special, which is something that I would normally expect from DC.
Totally.
We seldom get a collection of short stories featuring Marvel characters for fun holidays. I love these kind of things. Like, same. Even when they're bad, I'm like, I'm still happy I'm reading them.
Absolutely.
So it's always like just a bunch of different creators doing fun new things. This one featured writing by Rob Fee, Jerry Duggan, Jen and Sylvia Soska, Jay Baruchel. Oh, right. The actor. Crazy.
Which one did he do again?
He did the Punisher one. And Robbie Thompson. And then we have art by Ian Marin and Mike Spicer, Laura Braga and Arif Prianto. Jonas Scarf and Jordan Boyd, Luca Pizzari and Michael Garland, and Bob Quinn and Chris Peter. So an enormous lineup of, some established, some lesser known,
some
actors.
Newbies.
Yeah,
some actors
coming through. And it's a bunch of just very different horror stories.
Yeah, Elseworldsy Marvel horror stories.
It opens with Daredevil getting eye surgery, but Kingpin has organized it so there's a hallucinogen put into his eyes that makes him see his enemies when it's his friends, and he ends up killing all his friends. And then Kingpin,
yeah, he stabs Karen in the neck.
Even though it was super heavy-handed, I don't know.
That was cool. Yeah, I liked it.
It
was good fun.
And the art was a big part of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and a fun dumb concept. I wasn't a big fan of the Fantastic Four one.
Yeah, I thought that one was alright. It's sort of like, what if the Fantastic Four, when they came back, they weren't changed by cosmic rays, they were changed by evil aliens. I liked the Captain America one as well. That was pretty silly.
Yeah, that was heaps of fun. Captain America versus Deadpool and Wolverine. Iron Man. I think that was actually really fun. A great ending, too.
The Punisher story was kind of basically just like an origin story for what if the Punisher was a pirate.
What if the Punisher was the Phantom of the Opera?
Which is like, that's also fine. Yeah. I quite liked the final one where some kids break into Xavier's abandoned school for gifted dead mutants.
Yeah, and it's like a zombie tale with a really, really sweet kind of ending. Yeah, that was good. It was a good little collection of short stories.
I think these things are so fun because a lot of the time a little short story can be one of the most satisfying ways to read a superhero story.
Yeah,
and it's
agreed.
Cool to get like a whole bunch of new creators. You sort of start becoming familiar with their work, and that's always cool.
Well, Siobhan, that wasn't the only collection of short stories that Marvel put out this week. We also got Vault of Spiders number one, which spun out of the Spider-Geddon event. Now, I know last week we said, I hate Spider-Geddon. We both said it. I liked both of the Spider-Geddon tie-ins this week.
Same. What big surprises. But this is the thing. The main series, boo, sucks. All the tie-ins, great. Really genuinely fun.
Siobhan just put her mic up to her butt just then, just by the way, in case anyone didn't know.
You're welcome.
Vault of Spiders had writing by Jed McKay, Cullen Bunn, and Neela Magruder and James Asmus, with art by Scott Koblish, Javier Polito on the Cullen Bunn story, Sheldon Vella and Alberto Albuquerque and Juan Gedeon, and lots of different colorists too, just basically different stories from around the web of just different spider characters from different universes, featuring an excellent Cullen Bunn and Javier Polito. Western Spider-Man, yes. Very apt considering Red Dead is taking over the world at the moment. That was probably my favorite in this collection.
Yep, that was really good fun.
You put Javier Polito in anything, that's going to be my favorite.
He's the best. I loved the...
Oh, God, I love this.
Yeah, the manga-style sort of Robo Spider-Man. That was good fun.
That was awesome. It's so much better than the other kind of Edge of Spider-Geddon one that we got that was like...
built based,
yeah, the little girl that was kind of like almost like Neon Genesis Evangelion. Mm. This was a way more fun kind of Japanese take on Spider-Man. The final one, whatever, like the VR Spider-Man.
Yeah, I don't really care about that.
And the Savage Land one was pretty fun too. But yeah, just a good collection of stories with some mostly very good art.
But definitely for me, the like my far and away biggest surprise of the week, things that I enjoyed, was Spider Force 1.
Yeah, which I had no idea. Like, I just thought it was just going to be another unnecessary spider thing. It was written by Christopher Priest.
Yeah, the second I picked it up, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
With Paolo Sicaria on pencils and Oren Jr. and Craig Young on inks with Guru FX on colors. And, like, yeah, this is definitely bogged down by all of the weight of the Spider-Geddon event, but whatever. It's Jessica Drew, Spider-Woman, teaming up with... I don't even know who it is. It's like a bunch of spider characters, basically.
Yeah, there's like an alternate universe version of Peter Parker who calls himself Charlie from Earth something or other. What else is there? There's that other spider woman.
Spider Kid.
Kane. That guy.
Yeah.
Superior Octopus shows up for a little while.
Yeah, it was just really, really fun.
Like, really enjoyable. Even hard to tell you what happened in it. They're in an alternate universe and they might be stuck there. But it is like... Priest knows how to write superhero comics.
Yeah, definitely. It was essentially like they're stuck on like an apocalypse world now, and I guess it's about them trying to escape and get back to their families and, mm-hmm, and all mm-hmm. that. It was just really, really fun, and yeah, Priest nailed all the characters, and of course you have all the dressings that come with the Priest comic now, the kind of like weird title cards over, you know, the white text over black background, and it's a fun way to kind of do a series.
Absolutely. Really enjoyable.
Definitely. I also really enjoyed the next two Marvel books we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Wow.
So we got the final of the X-Men Black I guess miniseries, where every week we've got a new creator doing a different X-Men villain.
Mm-hmm.
And for the final one, we had Leah Williams and Chris Pacello. So on writing and pencils, with
loads of inkers and colorists.
Loads of inkers and colors, doing an Emma Frost one shot called "Hunger is Productive," and it was basically
absolutely loved this.
Like,
oh,
every
God.
Moment of this. Obviously, Pacello art always good,
but also like, I mean,
so Leah Williams.
The costumes are so good.
Yeah,
the clothes are so good.
Leah Williams wrote this and the next Marvel book I'm going to talk about. But
no way.
Yeah.
Wow, she's good.
I know, right? Like, but so this is a story of like Emma Frost basically tricking all of the X-Men, so Rogue and Gambit and some others, Nightcrawler, to get her into the Brotherhood. No, it's the Hellfire Club.
So she says, "Help me take down the Hellfire Club," and then she's like, "Psych, I am the Hellfire Club."
Yeah, but it's a brilliant, some incredible action scenes in it. Really well-written dialogue. A great way to handle the sexiness of Emma Frost in a way that isn't exploitative.
Yes.
It's just like this inherently part of her character.
Yes.
And you have to be able to write it or just don't even try.
Yes.
And Leah Williams did it so well.
She has such a great voice for her.
Yep.
She had a great voice for Rogue as well. I thought this was such a great issue. And Pacello, like... really outdoes himself. Like, I feel like this is the best his art has looked in something that I've read in a really long time.
Yeah, like, way better than all of his Doctor Strange stuff, and like, yeah.
It's just, I feel like maybe the huge team of inkers and colorists have made, it just sort of made it a bit clearer.
Yes, definitely.
And a little bit less, I think sometimes Pacello is best when he kind of reins it in a little bit.
Definitely, and here you have a lot of, like, scenes where the background is just a flat color.
Yeah.
Which I think made it a lot easier to follow.
But just gorgeous.
Just so good, and Emma Frost is just such a... is such a well-written character in this this issue, which is not something we get very often. Like, the last thing I remember reading her in was that awful Death of X-Men or whatever it was,
where she
covered Cyclops' death.
Oh, yeah. That was pretty bad.
I thought this is awesome. And Leah Williams is just like, I don't really know what she's done before this.
Yeah, me neither.
It's not a name I recognize, but... after this and the next point we're going to talk about, like, lock her down, Marvel.
Yeah.
She gets your characters and she's good.
She gets the female X-Men.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
So the last one we're going to talk about from Marvel is What If Magic Became Sorcerer Supreme.
Oh, man.
So these are the What If books. We got it in, I think, like 6 or 7 of them. Some of them have been pretty good. Like, none of them have been flat out bad, just unnecessary.
Yeah.
But this was my far and away my favorite one, like one that just definitely should exist as a one-shot.
Yep. This is a beautiful comic about, like, trauma.
Written by Leah Williams with art by Philippe Andrade and colors by Chris O'Halloran. And the title of it is a bit of a mislead. We don't actually see Magic become the Sorcerer Supreme in this issue, but basically, after she tries to attack Doctor Strange, he takes her on as like her his protege.
Yeah, she becomes apprentice to the Sorcerer Supreme. That's right. And it's like, what if Ileana had someone to help her through her traumas? What if she had someone to love her and care for her? And it's like such a gorgeous issue. The art is beautiful. The colors are phenomenal.
So good.
And the story is so well paced and so like action packed and fast and great, but also so emotional, so genuine, so sweet. Like, man, this really blew me away, this issue.
Yeah, and like I love that you had no idea that it was written by the same issues. They're two masterful one-shots.
Yes.
And that's something that like often comes with like years and years of comic book creating. And
yes.
Maybe she's been doing it for a long time and we've been too dumb to notice, but like I think she's a relatively new creator and like these are two like 5 out of 5 one-shots.
Issues.
Like,
yeah. Nate read these both before me and gave them both to me. Oh, sorry, the canonically lovely Nate read both these and gave them to me in one pile, and I don't think he noticed that they were by the same lady either. And he is incredibly picky about X-Men comics, but he was like, these are both great. You have to read them immediately.
Yeah.
Just amazing. So good.
And also, way to save these for the last of both the What If and and the X-Men Black series, because it makes me go like, oh, they were two really great little miniseries.
Worth it.
Yeah, definitely.
That was worth the paper that it was printed on. I hope they do something great with Leah Williams. Give her X-Men. Give her the whole universe. I don't care.
I would love for them to be like, there's one X-Men book now. It's written by this person.
Ooh, they'll never do it.
I know, but like, God, it would be good if they did.
I know. I agree.
I mean, that's not the only Marvel property that should only have one book. But
yeah.
It certainly is the main one that would benefit from it. Like, instead of having X-Men Red, X-Men Blue, X-Men all the other colors, have the one X-Men book, and then if you want to have like separate character spin-offs, do it that way instead of having, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think Spider-Man would be better if we had one Spider-Man
book,
and it was just Peter, you know, helping Miles become Spider-Man. That would be my perfect Spider-Man book.
Yeah, definitely.
But instead we have 16 Spider-Man books, and they're all fairly average.
So we've got two vague horror books to talk about. You've got one there called Midnight Mystery that came out through Alterna Comics. I only made it through a few pages of this.
Oh, really?
How was the rest of it?
I really enjoyed it. I thought this was really good fun.
It was like pretty late when I started reading it, and I was just like, no, it's too much text.
So this is written by Bernie Gonzalez with art by Wes Locha.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I like the art.
Yeah, the art's really, really cool, and it's about a private detective who set in the past, and he records all of his cases to sort of listen to later on. And in this, he is instructed to track down the son of like a sort of a crypt keeper-y style actor who passed away, and his butler wants to pass on the estate to his illegitimate son. So he tracks down the son doing some old school detective work, which is like pretty fun. It's pretty cool when the story has like the constraints of they don't have flipping smartphones and you can't just be like, ah, there he is on Facebook, cool. And then it gets weird. They go to collect the you know, to go and talk and be like, well, what's up with this? And he gasses them. And the end of the issue is the detective and the son gassed on the floor of the greenhouse cool. by the butler. I really enjoyed this. It was very well-paced.
Yeah, really good art. The art reminds me of a very simplified Darwin Cook on Parker.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely has that vibe. It's just like a, if you like private investigator stories, I think you'll enjoy this. This was good fun to me. If you liked, who's the private investigator in the Catwoman series? The Rebecca Catwoman series?
Slam Bradley
vibes. That was good.
Final book with a number one on it is Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Terror. An anthology book that came out through Ahoy Comics, which is the last appearance of Mark Russell this week. He had three appearances in this week's First Things First.
Good job, Mark.
Tom Payer, it's basically like a bunch of stories featuring Edgar Allan Poe.
I just don't care that much about Edgar Allan Poe, so I left it at the bottom of my pile.
So he besides narrating an opening thing about him, introducing a bunch of horror tales, it's not really about him. He's in the background of some of the comics, but they're just horror comics with this book ending of Edgar Allan Poe. So the first one written by Tom Payer is about a man who makes a deal with a devil just as he's dying, as about to die. So he never actually dies. His body just starts decaying, but he also happens to be a very famous pastry chef.
Oh.
And so as he's making these incredible pastries and cooking all these delicacies that everyone, all these, you know, high society people are like, oh my God, he's also like dripping pus and blood and bile cool. into as his body decomposes. You know, he ends up exploding all over them when he finally is released.
Horrible.
From life. And then we get a book, the story written by Mark Russell is actually pretty funny. And this is the Mark Russell I like. It is a horror tale featuring the mascot, or like a mirrored, you know, an analogy of the, analogy? Like a...
Yeah.
Yeah. Of
Analog?
Analog, yeah. Of a
Count Chocula.
Count Chocula.
I guessed from the
serial mascot. So this is called Dark Chocolate. And yeah, it's basically like a kind of like real horror take on Count Chocula's origin. So imagine a chocolate cereal eating vampire, but
that is,
told
that is
in a
what,
horror story.
Like Mark Russell is best at taking something that you're like, there is no flipping way that this can be good, and making something that's actually like, it's
yeah,
pretty good.
I really, really enjoyed this because it really was him. Like, there's a great little fun twist at the end, and it was it was very, very fun. So yeah, those are the two kind of like main ones.
That sounds actually pretty fun.
Yeah, I like Ahoy Comics. I think it's really, they're really, really printed. There's so much crazy backup material.
Yeah, cool.
There's a fun kind of comic book strip at the end by Hunt Emerson. And so there's poetry. There's letters sections. There's interviews.
God, that's so fun.
Yeah, and if you like, Mark Russell, there's a 2-page interview with him.
Cool.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, it's a good package from Ahoy Comics. Siobhan, that's it from First Things First this week. It's a lot of number ones.
Next week
seems to be a slightly smaller number one week.
Okay.
Which is exciting. But if you read any of these number ones and you would like to argue with us about them, the best place to do that is over at facebook.com/groups/Serious Issues Podcast. That's our Facebook group featuring thousands of comic book reading good people that talk about comics all the time, run by some lovely admins. And we make sure that the conversation is always civil and good and informative. And it's a great place to ask for recommendations on your favorite character or characters that maybe you don't know very much about and want to learn something about in the future. But yeah, head over to facebook.com/groups/Serious Issues Podcast to discuss this episode and comics in general. Now we're going to play a game called Siobhan Lost the 3-sided Die, and now we just kind of decide the publisher we're going to talk about next.
I did.
And this week, Siobhan, it's going to be...
DC.
DC first. Oh, great. Heroes in Crisis, issue number 2, written by Tom King, with art by Clay Mann and Travis Moore, and Timon Morey and Arif Prianto on colors, with Clayton Cowles on letters. And this is the big DC weird Tom King event right now, where there was like a
lot of people. There was some deaths. It was like, it was a bit like, what was that one that came before Civil War 2? Not Civil War 2, Hydra Cap. What came before Secret Empire? You know, the Pleasant Hill?
Oh, yeah, totally.
So it had similar, it reminded me of that in that they set up something very, very
Breakout?
Briefly.
Avengers Breakout or something like that? Yeah.
I don't know what it was. But sort of they've mentioned in a couple of comics very briefly that there is a place called Sanctuary where superheroes can go, superheroes who have committed horrible acts of violence in their life can go and talk to a computer about it, which is a foolproof plan as computers are never corrupted and it's like it's 100% safe and no one will ever get access to that information ever. And then either Booster Gold or a really terrible shitty version of Booster Gold, who's a big dumb idiot who makes everything worse, which I get is kind of part of his character, but not like this Tom King.
No, totally.
You fucking idiot.
Well, also, I did a terrible version of Harley Quinn, who may have also killed a lot of people.
Yeah, so it's either Booster or Harley killed everyone. Cool. It'll probably end up being neither of them. It'll be like, I don't know, they killed themselves.
Yeah. It was Tom King. It was Tom King.
That's
my money is on Tom King is going to write himself into this series.
Grant Morrison style. Just whatever.
There are moments in this that I do enjoy. I enjoyed the fight between Booster Gold and the Flash. When the Flash learns that Wally West has been murdered potentially by Booster Gold, but because it's Tom King, you just get fragments of story, and there's no satisfaction but as you finish the end of each issue, it's just like you just get these,
just everyone looking into the camera going, "Am I enough, Alfred?"
It's just a bunch of a bunch of dioramas that you just get like a little glimpse of, and then you have to walk around the science exhibition and see the next diorama.
Yeah.
And all of the talking to camera stuff, because it's them talking to the computer as they confess stuff, especially Superman shit.
Oh, yeah.
God, yeah. I don't care for it at all. Also, 9-panel grids aren't that good.
Yeah, you ruined it, Tom King. You took a good thing and you ruined it. You ran it into the ground.
Been reading Bone this week, which for the most part is 6-panel grid. 6-panel grid's real good.
I think, you know, it's like in that Batman book this week. It's not about the technology, it's how you use it. And Tom King has ruined 9-panel grids for us all. And he's ruined people talking to the camera. And he's ruined the narration not having anything to do with what's happening on screen. And he's ruined penguins. And he's ruined Harley Quinn. And he's ruined... I don't know what else he's ruined. He's ruined Batman. He's ruined... he's ruined Dick Grayson. Now he's Rick.
I like Clayman's art, though.
Clayman is so good. I think that's the thing that makes me mad about it, because I'm reading it and I'm like, I'm enjoying this.
Yeah.
Why am I enjoying this? Ah, Clayman.
Also, Clayman drawing like classic Harley Quinn costume as well.
Classic Harley Quinn costume. Even some of the characters that they've killed off, I quite enjoy it, because a lot of them are like obscure Teen Titans characters. I was a bit like, oh, you killed off Captain Steel? Oh, that's a shame. He was good. I don't know, like just... What have I got to say about this? Blah, blah, blah. It's yet another story where they're like, oh no, someone's going to figure out who Superman is. Oh no. That's never happened before.
This is your Batman impersonation.
But just like, does Tom King not... Has he not read, like, DC Comics?
I mean, everything has been done a million times before.
I know.
But now you're getting them as more heavy-handed than ever.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're going to keep reading this because we are gluttons for punishment, and also we like complaining about it.
Yeah,
because we are comic book readers after all, and that's almost as fun as reading them to begin with. Did you read Batman the Max Arkham Dreams by Sam Keith this week?
Yes, I did.
So I could not tell you a single thing about what's going on in this book. It looks so good, and this has gone in the pile of books that I do not read. I just look at the amazing art and then say, it's a great series. Everyone should look at it.
You know what I think I enjoy most about Sam Keith's art is that the Joker looks literally like a different guy in every single panel.
Yes.
Looks completely different in every single panel. And if that isn't the perfect interpretation of the Joker, I do not know what it is. He uses like different art styles. Different, like sometimes he looks almost like, who's the crazy one from The Sandman, The Dreaming? Who's the madness one? The little girl with the crazy bubbles around her head all the time?
Oh, yeah, one of his sisters.
Yeah, so sometimes it looks like that. Sometimes it's like this incredibly detailed close-up. Sometimes he looks like a caricature of, like, Jay Leno. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
It's so fun. And his version of Batman is, like, really compelling and really cool. This is so weird.
I love Sam Keith's art. It's so good. I want to see him just, like... I would prefer it if someone else wrote it, because, his madness in art form, I love. His madness in written form, I'm just like, oh, what am I reading? But
I know. Oh, man. But look at that variant cover by Kelly Jones. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I at least encourage everyone to take a flick through what this book looks like. It's
See
wild
how weird
as hell.
It is.
Sam Keith, of course, is the creator of The Max, and this is like the weird like he and the Max and Batman teaming up, going on a journey through the Max's mind and the dreaming and all kinds of wild shit.
The Outback.
That's crazy. The Outback. That's the one. So Doom Patrol, issue number 12 came out this week through DC's Young Animal imprint, written by Gerard Way with and Nick Darrington, with art by Jeremy Lambert and Dan McDade and Tamara Bonvillain. But we don't actually get a guide as to who did what. I don't know who the artist is, but because everyone's just referenced as Dungeon Masters, Barbarians, Druids, and Clerics, because this is a D&D issue. This is a great issue that I loved so much, because it's, you know, that the there was one of the ambulance drivers has the from the series that they did has a young kid who decides to go into dark magic in the series. This is like his redemption story, and it's their family on on a fantasy kind of voyage. That's, you know, may as well be a D&D campaign. But it is very silly, high fantasy stuff with them kind of like understanding their powers based off of their, you know, their skills in the real world. But it was just really, really satisfying. And then it ends and it's like, oh, you're going to need all of the skills you learnt in order to for the Milk Wars coming up. So this is actually set before the Milk Wars event that came out at the start of the year. So it's the most weirdly delayed, and it is the final issue of Doom Patrol, I guess. Yeah. Anyway.
Man, okay. I mean, fine. I don't know why I'm getting mad about it.
It's just very strange.
It's just very strange. What was it Gerard Way was doing that meant that Doom Patrol got delayed?
Writing a new series of Umbrella Academy and turning Umbrella Academy into a Netflix series.
Yeah, right. Ugh, Netflix ruins comics.
That is what the episode is called.
This is true, though. Stop taking our good writers. We want to pay them nothing.
Yeah. And complain about them doing everything. But there's a great back matter. You have
that is cool.
D&D cards for each character with their vitals, etc. And then there's even a map where you can then cut out all the different players and move them around the map.
That's fun.
Very, very cool. So, look, if this is the final issue of Gerard Way's run on both Doom Patrol and Young Animal, it's a good way to go out. It's a very strange kind of thing to think back on, because it started so strongly and then just kind of petered out into nothing.
And the art was so gorgeous the whole way through, but just
yeah,
I don't understand what that book was, really.
Yeah, but the actual main series of Doom Patrol I did enjoy, and this is a great way to cap it off. Milk Wars is the only kind of thing that I'd like that didn't enjoy. Just the two co-written with Steve Orlando, those two issues.
I didn't heaps enjoy Doom Patrol because I didn't understand what was going on in it.
I thought it made sense by the end. This is a good way to cap it anyway. I enjoyed it. So over to the Wildstorm now. This is the Warren Ellis and John Davis Hunt with Steve Bucciolato series, reintroducing all the Wildstorm characters into a new world orchestrated by Warren Ellis himself. And
man, oh man.
Yeah. So even though last week gave us the glimpse of Midnighter and Apollo, we've not seen in a long while. I was hoping we're going to get way more of them in this issue. Unfortunately, it must be in a future issue that we see them.
We get another tiny little glimpse of them in this issue. Another tiny little hint.
But instead, you just get a bunch of incredible action sequences between the other characters, and some great stuff with Michael Cray and the aliens and all manner of insanity.
This book is so satisfying. And one of the things that I think it's so clever is having we knew from the beginning this was going to be a 24 issue series because it says it on the front cover and you have a little arrow pointing to which is the current issue. And I like how tightly plotted and well paced this feels. Like now we're at 18 out of 24 and things are really starting to go. Half of this is just wordless action sequences and it's so good. It's so compelling. But there's still all these big weird character moments, and
Bendix is just wild as hell. And
yeah, I really love this.
It's shaping up to be a big war between space and Earth.
Yeah.
And all the rich people that live on both.
Yep.
Really love it.
Really, really great. And John Davis Hunt goes from strength to strength.
He's just improved so much as an artist since this series. I loved him to begin with, but he just gets better and better.
The good action sequences are amazing, and I think that's one of Warren Ellis's real strengths.
Definitely.
Great. Great, great, great. Love it.
So that's it for DC this week, which means now we're going to talk about Image. Sure, Image. Man Eaters, issue number 2, written by Chelsea Kame, Kate Niemczyk on art with Rochelle Rosenberg on colors. That's right, it's the Mockingbird team.
Doing the periods.
Doing a book about girls getting their periods and turning into dangerous cat monsters. And our main character is the daughter of a detective and
he's a homicide detective, and yep. the mother, who is not really around in the picture anymore, she is like a period cat hunter
attack force, yeah, I guess something like that. Neither of her parents know that she has just gotten her period, which is a thing that has been outlawed in society, and people take precautions so their children do not start to menstruate.
But how did she buy the tampons then?
Yes, I don't know. Maybe they're just around. But whatever. This is a great look at menstruation.
is this enjoyable to you as someone
absolutely.
Who doesn't menstruate?
But it's all about, you know, puberty and...
Yes.
I had sisters. I have a daughter. I have lots of female friends. And, you would be a fucking idiot to not know that this is a shitty thing that affects more than half the population.
Yeah.
That is still such an uncomfortable point of conversation for so much of society.
Yeah.
And this book is such an important one to exist. It also happens to be a very well put together action comic with great horror elements and incredible back matter and just great like in-world advertising.
Yeah.
It's the full package.
Yeah, the in-world advertising really, really makes me laugh because I really liked the ad on the front cover where it's like, she's your little princess today, but will she be a monster tomorrow? And then the bottom, it's like, symptoms of toxoplasmosis X include. And it's just all of the symptoms of having your period. And then halfway through, it changes into turning into a cat monster. Just fun.
Yeah,
enjoyable.
So, like, even if this didn't have the horror element, it would be a compelling comic. Because that is such an important and scary and weird time of life for not just the little girls, but also, like, their parents.
It's true.
I just think this is just such a wonderful book that I thought, yeah.
It's so enjoyable, and nothing has ever made me feel cooler for having my period.
I'm excited to see where this is going to go. And I hope Chelsea Kane gets nothing but positivity from this book being out.
Yeah. Also, one of the most fun pieces of back matter is Dead Samurai Haikus by 13-year-old Emily Powell.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Sick.
Just like a series of
so
five
cool.
dead samurai haikus, and they're really, really fun.
really enjoyable.
The last haiku is, I don't like haikus. It is too hard to write them. Okay, I'm done now. That's
genius.
The best kind of
genius
matter.
Haiku.
Just all 13-year-old haikus.
Yes.
Real good.
More content by 13-year-olds.
She should force 13-year-olds to write more haikus.
Absolutely. Get them off Twitter.
Yeah.
Whatever. Snapchat.
So we also got the final issue of Shanghai Red, a 5-issue miniseries written by Christopher Sabella with art by Joshua Hickson. This was a book about... It's a revenge comic, first and foremost, that begins with a woman who is experimenting with posing as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And while drinking in a bar, she gets thrown into a cell and wakes up on a pirate boat where she's forced into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
After taking over that boat, she returns to the town from which she was kidnapped and tries to reconnect with what remained of her life there, but also get revenge on those who...
And that's bloody revenge.
And, man, what a satisfying ending.
That's a great issue. Sometimes I had a bit of a problem with the art in this just because the characters, you sometimes lose the faces and you lose... I sort of had a little bit of trouble of following who was who sometimes, but... Christopher Sabella does a really, really great job of kind of putting into words that really hard position when you're a young woman feeling so trapped by the world's expectations of you and
sure.
what is possible for you to achieve. I was very like impressed by that. I thought that was very enjoyable. I liked this. I liked
this
too. A lot.
I'd recommend this in a big way when the trade comes out. But
absolutely.
On your note about the art, I totally get it. Especially when, you know, when you're reading it month to month and can't really remember where we've seen these characters before. But there is a grittiness that comes
absolutely.
With Joshua Hickson's art that I wouldn't trade with anyone.
Yeah, the tone of it is so perfectly encapsulated in the art and in the color palette.
Yeah. So, a really, really satisfying end to this. This is a extra sized issue, too, and considering they didn't charge any more for it, that's very cool. I loved the cover this month as well.
And the ending, like, I don't want to give anything away, but, it leaves it open for other potential stories. But I almost hope that they kind of don't revisit it. Like, that's such a satisfying ending, them just sort of...
Do the criminal route, Brubaker and Phillips route, and just do another book together with a similar theme or vibe.
Yeah.
Because they're two great creators. I mean, and the final issue, final the final page is just... the second to last page is just so good.
Yeah.
So satisfying. Reminds me a lot of the ending of the first Red Dead Redemption game.
I don't know what that is, but yeah, cool.
It's a game, a video game you play with a controller on your television.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah. Ice Cream Man issue number 8. Guess who was dumb enough to not even know it came out?
The next two, I'm so annoyed at myself.
We're going to talk about Fence until later. We've got Marvel first.
I literally hate myself.
She forgot to read Ice Cream Man and Fence, which were probably my two favorite comics this week.
I know.
And I knew they would be.
I was like, this is such an average week of comics.
Yeah. These are the Fence and Ice Cream Man are the two books where I see them in my stack. I'm like, cool, those are going to be my favorite books this week. And then they are.
Yeah.
And so, well done. this is written by W.R. Maxwell Prince with art by Martin Marazzo, who I just fucking love his art style so much. Man. Chris O'Halloran showing up for another great bunch of colors on a book again this week. But this was like a full-on anthology. We follow like a bunch of short stories set in this horrific world of Ice Cream Man, where there is a psychotic Ice Cream Man running around ruining people's lives, but sometimes not really. Like just... He's just somewhat linked.
Yeah, just shows up.
Basically a bunch of horrible scenarios showing up in this awful world.
Oh, man. Is it using characters that we've already seen?
I think these two ambulance drivers we've seen before.
Also, that's like the diner, isn't it? The
yeah, that's right.
Guitar player
so,
I think, yeah.
So this definitely feels like the end of Act 1, this issue.
Cool.
The whole time it's been building that there's this kind of fight between the Ice Cream Man and this mysterious cowboy who we know is like somewhat good.
Yep.
This is going to be. Do you want me to spoil it for you?
Yeah, just show me. I don't care.
All right. So
I'll read it.
It's like they give you such small glimpses as to the greater story that's being told here, and it's also maybe not even that important that it is. The two ambulance drivers are driving with someone in the back of their car. These are two drivers that are like, one of them has a similar affliction that the main character of She Could Fly have, where like there's always a voice that she hears telling her to do horrible things, and sometimes she doesn't, sometimes she tries to ignore it, and that's the kind of narration of the overall issue, as we see all these other horrible things happening in town. And then they finally, after like, you know, stealing a bunch of pain medication and taking all these different meds, finally realize like shit, there's a guy in the back of the car, remember? And they open it up. And it's the cowboy with a knife in his neck.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And, it's just, how they can tell such a, morose kind of weird collection of short stories and still end on a thing where you're like, oh, my God, that's right. And it just absolutely blew me away. Awesome. Brilliant issue. And then the back matter of this is, all these awesome sketches and then a color swatch gallery for each issue.
Wow.
Which is so cool. Like, these fun little designs.
They all have little ice cream names.
Yeah, they all got ice cream. All ice cream names. So there's all the issues were named after ice cream names.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Real good stuff. Just
two creators to really just keep your eyes on.
Definitely.
By everything they do.
And which means, I'm not sure if the first trade for Ice Cream Man has come out yet, but...
it has.
It has, right, sure.
Pick it up, guys.
Do you know if it collects issues 1 to 4?
I think it collects the first 5 issues.
Okay, sure. Right,
I believe.
Who knows what's going on next? They're taking a small hiatus and it's returning in January. And I can't wait. Best series. Such a good series. Goddamn. We've got Marvel to talk through now.
All right.
She's serious, everybody.
Guys, I'm very serious.
I want to talk about quickly Extermination issue number 4, written by Ed Brisson with art by Pepe Larraz, Aria and Endito and Dexter Vines, and Eric Arciniega. This is the kind of the end of the time displaced original X-Men.
Good.
So they're telling us.
Good riddance.
And in fact, one of them meets their end in a really, really kind of funny way. In fact, it was quite a shocking death that I showed you.
One
of the original X-Men dies in this issue, and I was not expecting it to happen. And when it did, I kind of was a mix of shock laugh. I was like, whoa, 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 whoa.
That's a good laugh.
Yeah. If you want to make that same laugh, pick up this issue. It's not that great of a series, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you get to see a really horrible death of a character that not many people like.
Exactly.
Although I liked this version better.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, one word: shunk.
Shunk.
Great word to die of.
Mm.
West Coast Avengers issue number 3 this week. written by Kelly Thompson, with art by Stefano Caselli and colors by Triona Farrell. My favorite issue of the series so far. This is, of course, the team of both Hawkeyes, Gwenpool, America, Kid Omega, and Fuse. Yeah, I think the relationship between Fuse and Hawkeye was strongest in this one.
Yeah, you know, I had a moment today where I was like, oh man, all of these characters are funny characters. You need a couple more straight men on this team, I think. You can't have two Hawkeyes plus Quentin Quire plus Gwenpool. Who's the straight man, other than America?
America's a straight man. I guess Fuse, the boyfriend, is straight? The straight man?
I suppose.
It's a wacky, silly comic.
It's a wacky, silly comic. You're very right.
I think
she's very funny. Like, I mean, the conversations between those characters are pretty funny.
Yeah, and they're fighting dumb, silly villains. This is like, you know, hot version of...
MODOK. BRODOK.
BRODOK. And then he's made a bunch of other weird monsters for them to fight. And now
he did turn Kate into a big hawk lady. Yeah. A giant hawk lady. That is pretty funny.
But now the giant Tigra is on their side. Or she's just on any side that allows her to beat up BRODOK. Look, I think it's very fun. And I think the comedy is well written. I get that, like, yeah, on any other comic, I think last issue I did feel like, oh, it's way too quippy, but
yeah.
I think it's all fallen into place now, and I'm really enjoying the pace of it.
I just want someone to make a whole line of the t-shirts that Quentin Quire wears. I want a t-shirt that says Future Phoenix. I also want a t-shirt that says I break for the X gene. Good. You're very funny, Kelly Thompson or Stefano Caselli, whoever ideas they are.
It's a good book.
It's a good book, guys. It's a good team book. Good team book.
Marvel 2-in-1, The Thing and Mr. Fantastic, came out this week, written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Ramon Perez and colors by Frederico Blee.
Chip back on his bummer vibe.
Yeah, this is just in a weird place where that Fantastic Four series has started, the one that Dan Slott's writing, and we know they're back, but also it hasn't come out in a while.
Yeah.
And where is it? When is it next coming out? And... now we have them. They have Mr. Fantastic returned, kind of explaining why he disappeared and without telling them. And I actually thought Chip did a good job of making it like Mr. Fantastic is a dumbass when it comes to friendships,
people's
emotions. So I think he did a good job justifying it in his head.
Yeah, I thought there was a pretty bad justification of being like, I just wanted to see if Doom could be good.
That was one of many motivators.
Yeah, I just think, I think that Hickman was kind of like, I'm out, and just left this like hilarious big mess for everyone else to try and justify. I think they overcomplicated it.
They didn't have to leave. I don't know whose decision it was to have the Thing and Johnny, you know, stranded on Earth without their family,
believing that they were dead.
Yeah, that's the dumb part. I don't think that Hickman left it in that. Like, Hickman just showed a panel of them, of the Fantastic Family, like, you know, flying into space and creating new universes.
There were lots of where was ways that
comic could have been so fun if they got like Al Ewing or someone to do like a hard sci-fi, you know, wacky comic with the Fantastic Future Foundation and stuff like that.
Or Mark Russell, just talking about the ethics of creating new worlds.
Perfect.
I would like that.
Instead, we got this weird, you know, stranded, sad story that I think Chip has done a good job of. But
Ben and Reed just fighting is like, I don't know. You'd think that they'd been friends for long enough that Ben would be like, ah, look.
Yeah. What would he say?
I thought that all these children had died, but I get it.
This is after you said, you just said that it's not a good
I have some problems. I didn't heaps enjoy this. I thought it was just a bit of a bummer. A bit of a bummer issue.
But it's not a bummer because of anything Chip's done. It's just like he's having to ride his way out of all these weird things that he's been put into.
And the art's great. Perez is great. Yeah. So good.
It's real good stuff. Black Panther, issue number 5, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Daniel Acuna, just writing a really, really straight space shooting book where we are finally getting a bit of that very, you know, deep Ta-Nehisi Coates kind of Wakanda lore seeping back into it, and it was very welcome when it shows up towards the end where he realizes who he is in the near future and what he has to do, and I'm looking forward to this being a bit more like the earlier series, like a merge of both of them. Like it is on one hand great to see him do a really slick action comic, but I do miss some of the Wakandaness of it all.
I really like this. I think it's so cool, and I love Daniel Acuna on the art. Like, this action sequences are so great and so gorgeous to look at.
It just feels weird.
The colors are beautiful
to be able to read a Ta-Nehisi Coates book in 2 minutes. That's all.
That's true. But you're not spending enough time staring at his pecs, clearly. I spent a long time looking at those pages.
2 minutes a panel. Hey, I really loved Tony Stark Iron Man issue number 5 this week, written by Dan Slott, with art by Max Dunbar and Gang Hyuk Lim, and colors by Dono Sanchez Almara, because this featured a character that I don't even know really existed, Arno Stark, who is the long lost brother of Tony Stark, who is a villain. You would love this issue.
Really?
It was like, what if Tony Stark was just straight up evil?
He is. Why doesn't anyone see it? He's a bad guy.
He's a good guy. Leave him alone.
Nah.
Leave him alone. He cries into his money every night because of the things you say about him. But this was a hilarious issue where Arno Stark gets hired by various awful companies around the world to fix their terrible problems. And in this one, this research lab have developed cows that don't have brains or feelings, so no one has to feel bad about
eating them
anymore.
That makes me feel worse about eating them.
Well, then he works out they have like a hive mind and they do feel pain, and then they he doesn't stop them from killing everyone that ate them.
Okay. I like that.
That's actually
cool.
Yeah, exactly. You would have loved this issue.
Oh, man.
I think
that might be the Dan Slott books that I should be reading.
I don't know.
I don't want to read any of them because they're all about
tech.
I'll leave this
with you. This one's not as much about tech, but I get what you mean when it is just like, it's a book about tech, everyone. Tech.
How great are tech industries? How great's Elon Musk? He's definitely not a bad guy in disguise.
But I thought this issue was really good. Even though I don't know what Slott's doing with this series, because it feels like a bunch of one-shots so far. But maybe that's kind of fun.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
But I'm looking for an actual plot to emerge at some point.
And I hope he's got something.
I hope Arno Stark is going to be like her main character because he's real, real compelling and enjoyable. Yeah, cool. The Death of Daredevil continued in issue number 610. Sorry, this week, written by Charles Soule with art by Phil Noto and Clayton Cowles on letters. And I love his art is so good in this.
Colors are so beautiful.
It's like a big Elektra story along with some Inhuman stuff. It's not.
Oh yeah, because he's doing it with Elektra again, right? Oh, he fights some Catholics.
Yeah, fighting Classic. Some weird new villain. But Elektra gets very upset because Matt still doesn't kill people. And so she leaves his life ill again.
Problem in most people's relationships.
This is this big...
One of you loves killing.
Final Charles Soule farewell to Daredevil after his relatively long arc. And it just... I don't know, just...
It just makes me miss Mark Waid on it.
Oh, God, that was such a good run, huh?
Mostly, yeah. It makes me miss Chris Samney.
So did you read Spider-Geddon? Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, issue number 311. Speaking of Chip Zdarsky, he just finished his run on this. And now we get Sean Ryan, Juan Frigieri, and Jason Keith taking on the series. I did not make it
this
far into this issue.
This was a very boring issue. I'm sorry.
It might just be because of Spider-Geddon.
Yeah, this whole thing has to tie into just... It's just a long, boring, impenetrable Peter fighting the Spider-Bro inheritor.
Yeah.
And it's very dull. And there's a bit of a fun moment with... the Inheritor tries to kill him with a jackhammer. That's pretty good.
The funnest way to kill someone.
And there's some fun Jonah bits, but didn't really heaps appeal to me.
Yeah, so unfortunately we'll not be sticking around on this comic anymore. And that's it for Marvel. Now we have other publishers. What do you got? You got two there. What do you got? You got Nancy Drew.
Yeah.
And a Britannia, the comic that only you read.
Me and Jim. I read Britannia, Lost Eagles of Rome, issue 4. This is the last issue of this this miniseries. I like that they
Valiant.
Do 4-issue arcs. You know, I realize this is the only Valiant book that I'm reading at the moment. I've really dropped off all the other Valiant books that
I don't think I'm reading any.
Because
they're about to relaunch a whole bunch of them, so it's partly that.
But this follows our...
Peter Milligan wrote this one, yeah?
Yes, Peter Milligan with art by...
Thank you
for keeping me on track. Robert Gill with Juan Castro, colors by Jose Villarubia, letters by Dave Sharp. And this is the ancient Rome set detective story
which
our the first ever detective who was trained by the Vestal Virgins and calls himself a detectioner is finding the golden eagle standards of Nero that were stolen by some bad guys in Egypt. And this is really good fun, and it's been building up to the last couple of arcs. It's really satisfying because they are standalone, but stuff does carry over. So we've got characters showing up. We've got real character development for our detectioner as he embraces his illegitimate son. And then we also have this ongoing story about, Nero and the fall of Rome. And it's actually really satisfying, and it's really good fun. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's goofy. I like it.
So as good as the first miniseries?
Yeah. I really think it stayed consistent in terms of quality.
Awesome.
Good
Great.
Fun.
And Nancy Drew, because I'm about to end the show on like just an overwhelming wave of positivity for fans.
Yes, please. So this is issue 5 of Nancy Drew by Kelly Thompson, with art by Jen St. Ong and colors by Trion Farrell. And this is also the final issue of this arc, I believe. And very, very satisfying ending, and just like what was a super fun detective story with teens. And the next case, Nancy might be going to jail. Nancy's been framed for the crimes of this story arc, which
is
that's fun. That's
crazy,
a fun way to
end.
Carry over. And, you know, her sort of Scooby gang has been set up really satisfyingly, and the world's really great. Like, I just think Kelly Thompson, they couldn't have chosen a better writer for this property than Kelly Thompson.
You mentioned earlier when you were reading West Coast Avengers that book needed more straight men. I find that with this series.
Really?
Yeah. Everyone.
I don't think there's anyone quippy in this. Like, they're all sort of like mildly sassy, but none of them are like explicitly funny characters. And Nancy herself is like quite straight.
Right. Okay. All right. I don't know. Maybe I just didn't connect with it, unfortunately.
I love this genre. Like, this genre, I think, really appeals to me as a kid who grew up reading like Harriet the Spy.
As a teen detective.
As a teen detective, as I still am, solving crimes at school. Just really good fun, and it looks so gorgeous.
Yeah.
If you like Hawkeye, if you like other Kelly Thompson books, you got to pick this one up.
Awesome. So final book we're going to talk about today is Fence number 11, written by C.S. Picat with Johanna the Mad and Joanna LaFuente on colors. This is the brilliant book about an all-boys fencing school. And this arc, which I believe is going to be like the final arc before...
it becomes graphic novels.
Graphic novel has been about the finals, in which all the boys learn if they're going to continue to be able to be at this school and fence on the team. And
feel
of course,
really tense.
They all come from like different societal backgrounds. So our main character has had to like, you know, string every penny and mm-hmm, ounce mm-hmm. of like, you know, fence skills he has just mm-hmm. to just to scrounge in. And then we meet another character that he verses. Well, one of the other characters that he's dreamed to be on the fencing team too. And every year, his parents pay for him to go to this college to try and achieve his dreams again and again and again. So the bulk of this was like a fight between, Aiden and, Aiden's ex-boyfriend.
Nice.
Everyone's rooting against Aiden because if Aiden doesn't get it, then they automatically get in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Aiden wins. But there's a twist. There's still a chance for Nick to get on the team.
I have to read this.
And there's one more. Yeah, like, fucking, of course you do. It's so good. What a brilliant series. It looks great. It's just so masterfully paced.
Yep.
I don't think that I have a more favorite comic of the year, just in terms of something that I was not expecting to connect with in any way and just fell in love with and look forward to every single time it comes out.
But, you know, like, Fence makes me so excited because it's such a female book, even though it's all men.
Yeah.
And it's such a testament to, like, fan fiction. Like, all these young women who grew up writing stories, long-running stories, like, every day for their whole teenagehood are now, like, paid writers. And it's such a, like, I just find that so cool.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Definitely.
I love it.
She's a very, very good romance writer, even though, like,
yes.
not that many characters are actually romantically linked.
It's and you know just, what she yeah. gets? She gets, which not a lot of, I would say, male comic book writers necessarily get, is that it's all about the build-up. Like, the thing that made C.S. Picat really famous is her trilogy of sort of historical novels called The Captive Prince.
Right.
And it's, like, hardcore erotica.
Right. Fantastic.
Which I did not realize at the time. But she was like, the two main characters, there's like two novels worth of build up before they even kiss. And then it's like six chapters of fucking. But like girls lose their fucking minds over it. And it's because there is so much tension. There's so much build up that you think you're going to like explode before anything happens. And it's so genius. She's so clever. I love it.
Awesome. Yeah, well, yeah.
Fence. And she's delightful. She's absolutely lovely.
And Australian.
Yes.
Very, very proud to call C.S. Picat Australian.
Yes.
Always the first book that I turn to when someone's like, what about Australian comics? I'm like, well, she's writing this.
Yep,
read this one. It's the fucking greatest.
Yep.
So, yeah, we're one issue away from the final single issue of Fence before they make the move to trades. Very curious to see what it's going to be like.
Will they kiss? Will they kiss?
There's so much going on. There's a beautiful moment at the end of this issue.
I'm going to read it. I'm actually genuinely just going to take it the second we stop recording.
Okay, great. Excellent. Well, guess what, Siobhan?
What?
We're seconds away from the second we stop recording.
I've never been so excited.
Because that is the end of this episode of Serious Issues. Give me that Nancy Drew thing, sorry, I'm going to forget it. If you want to follow us, you can. If you want to support the show, if you want to keep listening to us.
Oh, yeah.
Shit, you can't read Fence because we are going to turn the mics off momentarily and turn them back on again so that I can talk about Bone and you can talk about a weird book with no pictures.
Weird book with no pictures. Who would even like that?
Who are you?
I don't know.
If you want to get our weekly Serious Issues post show, be sure to go over to patreon.com/serious issues podcast. Kick us $5 a month and you get access to every single week bonus material plus a lot of bonus episodes that we've done in the past. A great way to talk to us over there as well. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week or right now.
Bye.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbroadcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
I mean, if you want. It's up to you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.